Welcome back to Witch Church. It's Mal. Hey, my friends, welcome to episode 81. I am so excited because on this episode, I got a chance to interview astrologer Bear River about asteroid Vesta. And honestly, Vesta has been my favorite asteroid to talk about and think about for quite a while now. And recently on Astro Twitter, on the Astro Twitter world, I noticed that Bear has the phrase vested in Vesta in his Twitter handle. So I started to think, all right, I think Bear is the aligned guest to invite on Witch Church to talk about Vesta. And if you're a student of astrology, you may or may not have dived into studying the asteroids. And I would say the most popular asteroid we hear about is Chiron. And Chiron is the asteroid located between Saturn and Uranus, right? But there's also the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And within the asteroid belt, we find the four asteroid goddesses, quote unquote. And those asteroids are Ceres, Pallas Athena, Juno, and of course, Vesta. And I do find Vesta to be the most mysterious asteroid goddess. And maybe that is because Vesta has a very mysterious, sort of sacred alchemical kind of job, which Bear and I will definitely speak to on this episode. And way back when, Vesta was considered the goddess of the hearth and the protector of the sacred flame. What exactly is a sacred flame? Hold tight. Bear and I will definitely discuss this concept more. I don't want to give it all away. Bear and I also discussed how Vesta's mythology and stories sort of transform over time. For instance, in pre-Hellenistic Greece, we talk about how Vesta was first considered, or was first named Hestia, and Hestia, the goddess of the hearth, was renamed Vesta later in history by the Romans during the Roman Empire. And we also tell the story of the Vestal Virgins and their role in the Roman Empire as well, which is so fascinating when we make the connection between the job of the Vestal Virgins in ancient Rome and the actual meaning of asteroid Vesta's placement in our natal charts. There's some juicy stuff there, my friends. And speaking of Vesta in the natal chart, Bear and I also talk about potential themes that Vesta could speak to in one's life, in one's nativity. And the literal theme of fire comes up a lot with Vesta placements because Vesta is the keeper of the sacred flame. But also, Vesta has a lot to do with personality, autonomy, sovereignty. I kind of think Vesta has something to do with queerness. And Bear and I also speak to Vesta's connection to sacred sexuality and maybe even sexual and religious trauma and the rejection of heteronormative patriarchal norms. So tending to the altar and developing a spiritual practice are also some themes that Vesta can speak to. So it's almost Vesta lives a very monastic life in a lot of ways. And I do believe that working with Vesta as an energy can help us perhaps in a sort of sexual healing context, but also in the context of becoming more dedicated to our spiritual practices. And I also suspect that Vesta relates to creating a safe home environment where one can truly be themselves. So a lot of juicy stuff in this episode. I think you're going to find the story and the archetypes that relate to Vesta / Hestia to be really fascinating. And I just want to tell you a little bit more about Bear. I'm sure you already know him, but Bear River uses he, him pronouns and is a consulting and lecturing astrologer based in San Francisco. Drawing on his experience as an activist, he explores the intersections of power, privilege, and politics as seen in the chart. He helps his clients hone in on strategies for grounded growth and embodied empowerment by bringing them back to the basics: bravery, authenticity, sovereignty, integrity, courage, and stewardship. Bear is a teacher for the Portland School of Astrology and a mentor for the Association for Astrological Networking, or AFAN. So I'm so excited for you to soak up some of Bear's wisdom about Vesta. Clearly, this is an energy that he has spent a lot of time with, and it's really inspiring to hear about how he has cultivated a personal relationship and practice with this asteroid. So perhaps he's going to give you some ideas of how to work with planetary energies on a personal level. If you are really drawn to Bear, make sure to follow him on Instagram and Twitter and YouTube, and I'll put all of his information in the show notes. If you feel called to book a session with him after listening to this episode, his website is also below. And I also posted this interview on my YouTube channel, Mallory Hasty Astrology. So if you prefer to watch instead of listen, please head over to my YouTube channel, give us a like, give us a comment. That link is also in the show notes. And please report back. Tell me, did this episode hit home for anybody? Did anybody recognize these sort of Vesta themes and stories in their own lives? Where is Vesta in your own natal chart? Print out your natal chart as you're listening to this and look for Vesta in the natal chart. The glyph for Vesta kind of looks like a little sacred flame. So I'm excited for y'all to ponder a little bit more about Vesta in your own natal chart. I hope you enjoy this interview, and we will talk next time.
Okay. Okay, Bear. I don't know, maybe, yeah, let's start with maybe a little bit about your journey with astrology in general. And I actually would love to know when you realized, like, I should be a professional astrologer, or this is going to be my career path. Like, what did that look like for you?
Almost, oh God, like 15 years between I love astrology and this is what I'm going to do. So it's a really, really long journey. So for those in your audience who don't know me, I'm Bear River. And I have a very mixed astrological practice. So I came into astrology at the tender age of 9. I am a sun sign Leo. My grandmother's born a few days before me. So my 9th birthday, she gives me this little teeny tiny pocket Leo book that like fit in a child's front pocket. So this little tiny thing about Leos, the only thing I remember is like lion, king of the zodiac. Like, yes, this is great. Fast forward to high school, I'm reading everything, mythology, psychology, Buddhism, astrology, tarot, just going down the metaphysical deep end. But it wasn't until those the great American eclipse, so those Leo eclipses, Leo and Aquarius ones in 2017, that I realized I'm definitely doing this professionally. There was a brief stint in 2012 or 13 where I tried to start a blog and very quickly was like, wow, writing horoscopes is an overwhelming amount of work. This is not for me yet. and went back off and did a bunch of mid, you know, 20 something year old people stuff. And then in 2017, I went and spent my first night under the stars. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so there's not a lot of like no tent fully outside, that type of camping, or there's always something over you. This was a nice clear night in Oregon, and I got invited by some high school friends to come up to be right under the path of totality randomly, like had to leave, pack up in 2 hours and drove through the middle of the night to get up to Oregon to arrive there at like midnight or 1 a.m. so that I would be there the morning of and stay up all night just watching the stars. And I happened to be lined up with these trees, and so I'm laying in this way where like the one farm light is out of my peripheral vision, so there's no light whatsoever except for starlight that I can see. And I'm looking past this tree, realizing like, oh right, from the perspective of trees that are fixed, like they get a sense of the movement of the sky in a way we never really can. And I'm watching the stars just rise over the horizon and watch Venus rise and how much light Venus casts. I'm just having a conversation with the trees and the stars, being a little animus weirdo in the quiet of the night. Watch the sun rise. Everyone wakes up. We're wearing our special glasses, waiting for the eclipse under the baleful rays. I did not know that it's not something that the old school astrologers would have recommended. So I'm hanging out under this eclipse, just like, this is great. I watch the stars. I watch Venus rise. I watch the sun rise. Looking, oh, full total eclipse. Wow, this is bonkers. Like, saw the shadow snakes and stars pop out and color disappear, all of that. But it was kind of over that night before the eclipse, and while the eclipse was hitting totality, and I peek through the daytime sky to see the stars, like that image. Always forget, but I feel like so many people who are into astrology have seen that one woodcut image where the astrologer's peeking past the veil of the stars, like, you know, your own spheres behind. And I had that moment where I was like, oh, if I can talk to the stars, like, right, that's astro logo, star talking, star wisdom. If I can talk to the stars, like, that's type of medicine, storytelling medicine. You know, my matrilineal side is Alaska Native, and storytelling is very potent and important medicine. So I just had this night and afternoon where I was realizing, okay, if I have this gift or this ability, then I have a responsibility to share it. And if I'm gonna share this gift, I'm already spending all my time and attention anyways, just thinking about this always, like, then obviously what else would I do? This is what I am doing. So rather than fight against my work schedule to carve out some time to be under the stars, why don't I just flip the order around and just be an astrologer and then figure out how to like be housed and fed so I can keep doing the star talking.
Yes, that is the dream, to be housed and fed while, yes. while talking to the stars. That's all we really want here. That's amazing. You know, it reminds me that right now I'm in an astronomy class with Gemini Brett, and my mind is blown how much astronomy, I'm so astronomy illiterate as an astrologer, and you kind of just reminded me that a lot of astrologers today in 2021 or whatever, we don't get out enough to go look at the stars and really commune with the astronomy of astrology, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was really fortunate 2018 and 19 to be living up in the Northwest when Brett was there. And so I was going to the Washington State Association of Astrologer WASA meetings. And so once a month I'd see him and be like, oh, hey, Brett, okay, so you told me to do this one thing or to look at this one star. So I've been doing that for the last month. And then he'd be like, okay, so this is your next assignment. You know, so a couple times a year I get to chat with him for a few minutes about some astronomical something or other. And it was actually talking with Gemini Brett that I really started coming from that perspective where it made so much more sense. Like, Buddhism plus mythology plus astrology plus like an evolutionary perspective. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff that a person can explore around karma and past lives and in that framework, if that makes sense to a person. I don't think that's necessary for astrology to work by any means. But coming from this animist perspective and really just like connecting earth to sky the way that Brett talks about is what made everything finally come together and make sense in a way where it was like, oh, obviously this is what I have to do. And the more I lean into it in that particular way, the more and more it makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Things are like kind of clicking, even though this is like definitely the hardest class I've ever taken in my astrological studies. Like this is, it's difficult, but it's something about it. It's like, sometimes it almost makes me cry, like thinking of, I don't know, like it's like, I don't know if it is resurfacing some past life of when I was looking at the stars a lot more than I am in this life. I don't know. But I really like that bear. And I'm wondering too, as you started to study your own chart more and more, was there ever like a time where you were looking at your chart and certain placements and you were like, yeah, I'm sold. Like that chart, that delineation of my X, Y, and Z, like that makes so much sense for me.
Yes. And it's been really different techniques at different periods of time. So when I was younger, like teenager to early 20s, it was more evolutionary astrology and the square to the nodes and like unpacking that nodal story where I'm like, oh yeah, Neptune, these outer planets, these nodal things, past life story, oh yeah, which I think a lot of folks who maybe know me more as like this like traditional Hellenistic leaning astrologer might be like, what? Bear? Nodal story? Evolutionary astrology? What are you talking about? Because it's been with, you know, with like a Hellenistic tradition and reading like, oh yeah, I've got this like little Leo stellium and like, oh yeah, those planets are combust. Oh, right. That's what besieged means. Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah. That's not actually a dignified plant. Oh, like that's one of the first things that I started exploring is I don't know about this dignity stuff. That sounds harsh. That sounds kind of oppressive. I think that's probably wrong. Very just like, I think this is bullshit. Let me go prove it. And so I went and did my research and was like, oh, this isn't bullshit. I've been read to filth. These planets are problems for me. Here I was thinking that these planets were my friends and they're like, they're limping along. They need some help. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah. But more to our topic today, Vesta. Vesta is we're going to give the asteroids planetary status. Then Vesta is my most angular planet. And getting into Vesta, I think, with a really deep, deep, deep set of like tertiary and secondary interpretive principles from any of the like Hellenistic through Lilly era traditional techniques, one could arrive at the same conclusions, but Vesta will get you there in 10 minutes. And the other ones you're like, this distribution and this overlay of this quadrant system and whole sign and equal house, and we could just talk about Vesta instead, and it's just so clear.
Well, I'm, you know, I have a feeling we kind of have similar outlooks to, you know, how we look at charts, because I've definitely gotten a lot deeper into Hellenistic in the past couple years, and yet the asteroids are something that are so invaluable to me. I could never give them up. And I know that some maybe more Hellenistic traditional practitioners don't really use the asteroids because in a traditional astrology reading, maybe we're only using the seven traditional planets. But I'm glad we're kind of talking about this, like two Hellenistic astrologers who do value the asteroids. And specifically when I saw your Twitter handle say you were vested in Vesta, I was like, oh, yeah. I want to talk. I was like, I want to talk to Bear about this, because I told you Vesta has always been my favorite asteroid goddess. And I do put that in quotes because I know some of our audience probably won't completely resonate with the phrase asteroid goddesses. And I don't necessarily think we need to overly gender who the asteroid goddesses are, but we have Juno, Pallas Athena, Vesta, and Ceres as our sort of asteroid goddesses. And out of all those four, Vesta has really always called to me in a way. And I know you've also felt sort of a calling to work with this asteroid. I would love to know, like, when you started kind of feeling this asteroid coming to you, like, what did that feel like?
I think I first started noticing Vesta actually like in high school. So that was back like, we're talking like the mid aughts, early aughts. This is a long time ago, almost 20 years ago. And the first time that I took a vow of celibacy. So I was just like reading a whole bunch of random sources, anything I can get my hands on. I was probably like deep in the free articles of astro.com, just reading random stuff. And I remember reading something about Vesta and sacred sexuality, and that like the Vestal virgins, like it wasn't necessarily about chastity per se, but there was something about like sacred sexuality. And I was a little like militant zealous Buddhist child at the time. So I was like hardcore, we don't do sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So I'm gonna be celibate. And I think that's the first time I really started thinking about sexual energy in like what now I would kind of describe as like libidinal energy. So like libido energy, right? Just like creativity, eros, as fire. And so I was like 15, 16 the first time I took a vow of celibacy. I think did it again at like 19 and 21. So it was like in that time period that I first started really feeling this need to have a very disciplined and more variously ascetic or monastic type of relationship with sexual energy and creative energy. And then kind of looking back, I can see different periods where like at the time I didn't realize it. And now I'm like, oh yeah. And then all of the altars, and there's been candle magic going on for a really long time. But I think it really wasn't until, you know, being so fixed heavy with my placements, it can be a little slow on the uptake. I don't think it was until the last 2-3 years that I really started leaning into like how to develop a personal relationship with Vesta. And then in this last year that I was like, okay, I'm vested. I'm doing it. Like, you have a dedicated altar. You will get the first prayer every morning, all mornings, like, per the way that from like the Orphic Hellenistic period. We can talk a bit more about that. So in getting into the Orphic hymns, getting into that kind of reconstruction of the Hellenistic type of religious practice, in lots of air quotes, so many air quotes around every word I just said in that sentence, but kind of leaning into the planets and the asteroids as intelligences and beings or spirits, leaning in that direction is when I really just like capital V vested in Vesta, here we go.
Oh, I love it. Okay, you're the right person to talk about this asteroid then. Okay, well, now I'm kind of wondering, our listeners are probably thinking like, well, what does sacred sexuality and like a vow of chastity, like what the heck does that have to do with this asteroid? And maybe this is a good time for you to take us into like a little bit of like the mythology or the story of like how this goddess or how this figure showed up in the lives of ancient people. And yeah, why did this goddess have something to do with like sexuality and altar worship and all of that stuff?
Yeah. The sexuality piece, I'm still puzzling where that connection comes from, but I can definitely get us to the altar piece. So we take it way back to the Hellenistic time. So we're going back to Greece, we're going back to like, well, before Greece was Greece, right? So since I'm not grounding this in any particular source material, I'll just kind of asterisk that I'm pulling a lot of this from, yes, from Demetra George and Asteroid Goddesses. Yes, also from Jen Sart, who I've had quite a few discussions with about Vesta and Hestia. And then just kind of a hodgepodge of the very few citations that we get in the Greek tradition around Hestia. So Hestia is how the Greeks would have known her, and Hestia was the goddess of the hearth. Hestia is the firstborn and lastborn daughter of Kronos. So Kronos, our fearsome sky dad who likes to eat his children, Hestia's firstborn, first to be devoured, last to be disgorged. So she gets this first and last thing going on that's really important. Zeus, you know, her brother, youngest brother's like, cool, we're overthrowing dad. Great, let's divvy up the kingdom. We're doing our thing. And everything gets allotted, and Hestia gets fire. She gets left alone also. She doesn't have to get swept up in any of this, like, utilizing women as bargaining chips. And this is something that we see that gets carried over into the Vestal Virgins in Rome. So Hestia is like, yo, you alone of all the ladies, you just get to, like, have free reign and do your thing. And Hestia is associated with the hearth, right? So this central fire. Hestia gets the first of all offerings because she's associated with the hearth where those offerings would have been made. And so, kind of extrapolating for the sake of brevity here, there's a few interesting things that we see. There aren't really any temples to Hestia, which makes sense because everyone had a fire to cook from in their home. So why would you go build a whole extra temple when every single person's got one? In the few temples where that are dedicated, there's like two that have survived, or the very, very few images that were created of Hestia, she's depicted as a woman in a simple cloak and robe, just like regular lady, which makes sense. I think it's easy to imagine ourselves back in the ancient day. Well, we would all encounter a regular lady who's just in a simple cloak and robe around a fire on a day-to-day basis, most of us, either a woman that we lived with or like because she was our wife or a companion of some sort or a sister or a mother, right? To use these like gendered terms, understanding that their gender back then and our gender back then now are different schema and systems, right? So Hestia is a goddess who is associated with fire that is the central fire from which like civilization can happen. All of the offerings to the gods that are made that keep civilization functioning have to be made over this fire. And the first and best of every offering goes to Hestia. And so we see that like before any other prayers would be said, you pray to Hestia. Before you offer some meat to insert God here, you offer some to Hestia. Anytime a new city is founded, the fire from the central temple of the city that people came from gets taken from that place to the next place. And if the fire should go out, the fire can only be rekindled in a way that is absolutely pure. And so they would use mirrors to collect the rays of the sun to start the fire. So there's this, like, we see in the very, very origins, this note that it's almost hard to explain because the association is with fire itself in some ways. And so it's like, well, what makes being human possible? Cook fire, right? What makes civilization possible? It's the cooking fire, the hearth fire that gives us a village versus just an encampment, like the permanence of that fire. So if we're thinking about the like Thomas Taylor translation of the Orphic hymns, the more kind of rhymey, couplety, very Anglo version. And then we see we're talking about, you know, daughter of Kronos, venerable dame, the seat containing of unwearied flame. you know, in thee, the gods have fixed place, strong, stable basis of the mortal race. Got the Patrick Dunn, which is a little more accurate, and we can talk about that one too, but there is this just like the fire that underpins being people being possible. And I feel like that makes sense that people would eventually associate that with sex, but it's a very long, circuitous connection.
Right. Oh my gosh, I got chills when you were talking about how they lit the fire with mirrors, because I think that really gets at like how sacred this flame was that sort of Hestia is kind of protecting. And this kind of idea that this is the sacred flame. And if we're going to make a new city, we're going to like take a part of that flame over to our new city. I mean, it's kind of a beautiful metaphor, but I would also ask the listeners to kind of imagine how difficult it is to keep a fire going 24 hours a day. Like if you were to just go outside in your backyard, yeah, you could probably like light a fire in your fire pit or whatever, but you try keeping that going for all day, every day, in the name of the protection of your city. Someone is going to have to be there 24 hours a day watching this flame, because it's not as easy as it looks, right? And, you know, what if it rains? What if there's a war and we got to leave the city? And what if we're attacked? And it's a very difficult thing to be this sort of overseer of this sacred flame of your city, right?
Giving me chills. Yeah. There is this definite, like, and there can be no stopping.
Yeah. And that's kind of given me the vibes of she is like the first and last, you know, like there is no end sort of situation. So this is really interesting. And kind of relating to, I wanted to comment on this idea that in the rare times when we do see Hestia or Vesta as like a statue or a painting, the fact that she is very plain and simple, almost like your mom or your the neighbor who's making cookies or whatever. But there is something much deeper and beautiful about that. And it was kind of reminding me that, you know, all humans have this sort of sacred flame of divinity within them. And there's something there about like the simple person or the plebeian also having this like spark of God. And also to relate it, we'll get into the sexuality stuff, but no matter who you are, king, queen, peasant, prisoner of war, whatever, like sex is part of your life in some way. So I don't know, like it feels very almost right that Hestia was not presented as this like beautiful mythical fire goddess, and that she was just like your mom or whatever, like, you know.
yeah just simple, like as simple and plain as fire. And one of the things that I really love, this is in the this is the Patrick Dunn translation and commentary of the Orphic Hymns, which is beautiful. It's got the original Greek as well for those who can read Greek. But the words that are closer to the original in English have this, like, they evoke the sound of fire, or at least I think a lot about that, that, like, you know, home of the blessed gods, the strong foundation of mortals, eternal, many shaped, loved, and green as grass, smiling, blessed one, you know, forever blessed, cheerful, holy. And there's some that like have this association of like the crackling of fire and associating the crackling of fire with the sound of her laughter.
Mm.
You know, so that gives me very like, yeah, that's like grandma attending like over the fire, especially like, you know, I had the distinct privilege of spending time at like an old farmhouse as a kid and learning how to cook over a wood burning cooking stove. And there is something about that sound of like the crackling of fire, the splitting of the logs, that does sound like laughter, does sound musical and cheerful and delightful. And when those sounds are kind of intermingled in your memory with these offerings, whether they're like these goodies or treats or tea or like the experience of being cared for, that does just like creates this ambiance and feel that it makes sense that it wouldn't be this depiction like Artemis or Athena or any of these other ones, because it's not this like, I almost said like psychedelic, but it's not this like oneric, astral, mythological, imagery-based magical praxis. It's so physical, somatic, animistic, just grounded in like the things that we can touch, which makes sense because there's this link between, you know, the Titans. Kronos is one of the Titans. You know, Hestia is the first of the Olympians who was born of the Titans. So it makes sense that we're seeing that kind of like the last connection to the primal forces as also being like the first step into the Olympians, which are much more about like social civilization types of gods, if we're thinking from like a folkloric perspective.
Yeah, totally. I love to like, because of that like somatic feeling of Hestia or Vesta, I like to think of ways that students can see astrology in real life. And it's kind of making me think of like, okay, have you ever like just gotten home from like the airport or like a terrible day at work and you walk in and to your house and like someone is cooking you something that smells really good? Or do you ever walk into your house after being in a blizzard and like feel the heat? Or have you ever taken a hike and returned to your campground after a really long day and sat by the fire? Like, I think all of these things are real life ways we can almost think of Hestia working in our daily life.
Yeah. I mean, even like thinking about a lot about light, especially since like, you know, talking and interacting with Brett, you know, how important it is to develop a relationship with sunset and just the sheer amount of lumens that you're interacting with so that your eyes are prepared to adjust to darkness to be able to see the stars at night. You know, if you spend so much time under and around really bright lights, it can take a while to get used to how long your eyes need to adjust to nightlight in order to have a more accurate interaction with the stars. And like most of us aren't far enough from light pollution to have that pure experience. But thinking about Vesta, you know, for anyone who does wake up before sunrise, if you wake up before sunrise and it's still dark, try to avoid turning on any lights and just light one candle. See how much light one candle throws and how that changes your relationship with perceiving sunrise. If candlelight, firelight, Hestia or Vesta is the way that you enter the daytime, it changes the type of relationship you can build with Helios, with soul, because the experience of what sunrise does becomes different. But you gotta just kind of like do it a few times to feel it, to understand what that's like.
Right. And I'm wondering, Bear, okay, so in the mythology of Hestia, from my understanding, she asks, or Kronos gives her permission to remain a virgin. But in the context of like these stories in pre-Hellenistic Greece, virgin did not mean the same thing as it does now, or like the connotation of chastity. Like something Demetra George says in Astrid Goddesses, she says here, being a virgin meant that she was whole and complete unto herself, self-contained, self-possessed, and self-fulfilled. A virgin, therefore, was not barren, but especially fertile, as in a virgin forest that had not been violated or depleted. And I kind of want to sit with that. Like, how interesting is that? Like, how I think the patriarchy and heteronormativity has really skewed that definition of virgin as something that is more like chaste or without sexual interaction. But I guess in Hestia's context, like, that's actually not what it meant. It meant she was free to be, to own her own self, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I really, like, when I think about it, you know, I always like kind of thinking like Baz Luhrmann style Romeo and Juliet, like, you know, take the old words, but make it really modern, you know? And so I imagine her being like, all right, cool. So like, no, I don't want to be bothered with all that, but like, please leave me. No, I don't want to have, do I have to like have a partner and do that whole exchange? Cause I'm perfectly content. You could just leave me alone. Actually, me and this fire, we're cool. I'll make you tea. How about that? That's kind of how I imagine that going. But yeah, it's this like virgin forest, unspoiled. You know, when we get to the Romans, we see that it's very much about like, okay, so as a woman, you aren't property. You won't be traded from your father to your husband and then be like literally an object that is exchanged for monetary wealth purposes. You can be complete unto yourself, own yourself. We see with the Vestal Virgins of Rome, they become the only women who can own property and bequeath property, which is just absolutely enormously huge. And so thinking about Hestia in that context, yeah, it's like, okay, so you get to be a virgin. You get to be unperturbed, undespoiled by other people's like agendas for you. You are free to exist for yourself as yourself. But in any patriarchal culture, that's just the most radical and the most awesome.
Oh my gosh. You know, not to bring my own chart into this where it's not, where this commentary is not wanted, but I do have, I have Vesta in my 12th house, and the 12th house maybe can be a little bit about what we fear. And I do find myself like having a pretty big fear of not relationships or love, but the price that, the social price of, you know, being in a relationship, being in love, being sexually involved, like it's not, and that's kind of, going back to the Vesta Hestia, like being like, all right, dad, let's actually, yeah, I'll tend to the flame, but I'm going to do my own thing. And I don't want the responsibilities of what it means to be a traditional whatever. So there is something really, there's a queerness to Vesta, I would say. Maybe not in like a purely sexual way, but there's a queerness in the sense of she's interested in living her life without anybody's rules but her own.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like the, you know, not gay as in happy, but queer as in, I actually didn't ask you about profanity. I don't know if your listeners want to hear the rest of that.
No.
You know, queer as in fuck you, right? That type of queer, that is like this queering or problematizing or interrogation of normativity itself.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that. And it's so funny because once, you know, time goes on, the Roman Empire pops up. And that's when we see in history the Vestal Virgins. And kind of to explain a little bit of the history to the listeners, because I do find it really fascinating to think that the Roman Empire really did have a temple dedicated to Hestia, who then became Vesta in ancient Rome. And they had a handful of women, girls, that they called the Vestal Virgins. And as you mentioned, these Vestal Virgins, they had special powers almost in society that quote unquote normal women did not have. But it came as at a price, because they were the priestesses of Vesta's altar. They were in charge of cleaning and doing sacred spiritual cleanses at the temple every day. They had to keep the flame of the Roman Empire going. From my understanding too, they started pretty young. Like they got drawn in like around like 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah, and by eight.
They would have to serve like a 30-year, I don't know what we could call it, a 30-year...
term of service or...
Yeah, term.
Contract or something, yeah.
A 30-year term of virginity or something. So, but they really could not have sex. Like they had, supposedly, they had to take this vow of chastity in order to be a Vestal Virgin. But like you said, they had perks in that Roman society. I'm pretty sure they sat first row at the theater. If they saw someone, I think Demetra George wrote something about if they saw someone going off to be executed, they had the legal power to be like, yo, homie, actually, we're not going to execute you today. We're going to set you free. Like they had really interesting powers, which I just find fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the being free, not being anyone's property, being able to have property, those are the ones that I just keep coming back to. Like that's enormous, especially for the Romans to grant that. And then the additional, like, and then once you've done your, you know, once you've served your tenure, you're free to go off and do what you want. And so now you can be, you know, and at like 38, it's still possible to have a family if you want to. And so they're like the only people in society who can have this experience where they are free from some of the really grievous pitfalls and then can go on to still have family, but then have property. So it's like this very, very interesting setup and dynamic that they have. But yeah, on the other hand, if that fire goes out, you die. If you have sex, you die. And it's, you know, there's some sources say that if they were caught having sex, then they would be burned alive. Other sources are like, no, you could not touch or harm a Vestal. And so they were just like, here you go, we're gonna bury you alive now because no one touched you. We just let you die. Bye. So either way, there's just this, like, the importance of rite and ritual, though, is just from Greece to Rome, that stays the same. And so there is this, like, you belong to yourself, but in belonging to yourself, society will support you. However, you must dedicate at least some amount of your effort to society as a whole. If you're not going to do the family thing, that's cool. Then you have to do like the group project then.
Right. Like that's such like an interesting, like they were a celebrity of society. Like they really were. I mean, they were worshipped as though they were like angels, and they were seen as like divine figures. So it's so interesting to think about how this, like, I think the dichotomy or the sort of idea of who Hestia and Vesta was as society goes on, I think Hestia is a little bit more free, and then we skirt up to the Roman Empire, and okay, now there's like this thing called the patriarchy, and now we have these norms like property gets passed down through the patriarchal lineage. So that means if I have a woman and she has my baby, I need to keep her close to me because that baby is going to inherit my property and my name. And if she goes off and sleeps with someone else and has another baby daddy, that's going to fuck everything up for me. So this whole thing about, like, in, I guess, in a socio-political kind of idea of how Vesta is now interacting in the Roman Empire, this free woman, okay, there's a price to that, though. Like, you could get buried alive if you slip up or whatever it may be. So it's kind of interesting to think about this asteroid showing up in someone's chart now. I mean, we all have Vesta in our chart somewhere.
Yes.
So yeah, how the heck are we supposed to, like, I don't know, bring these like really odd ancient stories of Vesta and Hestia into our own natal charts and be like, oh, well, I don't know. Like, I'm really looking forward to kind of picking your brain a little bit more about like actual Vesta in natal charts.
Yeah. So that is I have two current just astro obsessions / kind of research and beta projects that I'm working on right now. And one of them is Vesta in the natal chart. So I'm getting a lot of folks who, even if they don't mean to talk about Vesta in the natal chart, Vesta shows up really prominently. And so I'm seeing Vesta show up with folks who have this very interesting, you know, like professionally, Vesta shows up in folks who have relative freedom and autonomy in the work that they do, but it must be done in a very particular way, like bakers. Bakers work really odd hours where, like, typically, like somebody who's like a really busy, productive bakery, those folks like start their day at 4 a.m. They're off by the time people are coming to get those baked goods. And so often they work either completely alone or they work with just one other person. And so they're, on the one hand, totally free to do whatever they want. If you're by yourself in the bakery, play whatever music you like to, talk to yourself the whole time. But baking, as anybody who's been in like the culinary world knows, baking is science. Hot cuisine, like, you want to make yourself a stir fry, it's a little of that, a little of this for some random amount of time, it'll taste fine probably. You can't do a little of this and a little of that when you bake bread. The humidity in the air will affect how much water you need to hydrate the flour. And if you get the proportions wrong, it doesn't work. And I use baking and like beer brewing specifically as examples because the interaction between fire and those other components in the hearth actually matters significantly. If you mess it up, as we learned with the Salem witch trials, you end up with bad molds and bad yeasts and bad bacteria in your bread or your beer. It's just liquid bread, right? You end up with the wrong things in there and they can actually like make you hallucinate. They can actually undo your society rapidly. And so that fire that the Vestals are tending, and this is like, as Jen Zart explained it to me and just exploded my brain open, that fire, that sacred fire, is not about maternity type, like it's about making things sterile, like an operating theater, sterile, like a magical theater, right? If you want to do your like magical cleansing, you don't do it in a dirty bathroom, you clean the bathroom first. And so it's that fire of like anyone who's ever made beer, you sterilize everything the beer goes into first. So it's that type of fire. And so like, how do we take these really old weird stories, right? Okay, so where in my life am I free and autonomous? But what are the particular rules, procedures, and protocols I have to engage in order for my freedom and autonomy to interface with society in a way where like the result is desirable?
Wow, yeah. Yeah, my mind is blown by that for sure. Yeah, and I'm even thinking of like, if we have a listener here who, I don't know, like maybe fire is part of your job in some way. Yeah. Like you said, maybe you are a baker. Maybe you are, I'm thinking of like putting pottery in a kiln, or I don't know, maybe there are firefighters out there who have Vesta in their chart. I'm not sure. But I'm thinking about, they would be more putting fire out though. And I guess Vesta is a little bit more about keeping the fire going. But I don't know, it feels very interesting to see how this archetype could show up in the 21st century.
Yeah, now I'm thinking like, have I seen any mechanics? I've mostly seen like bakers, folks who are into brewing, things related to like farming, where this relationship between things being sterile, as in like clean and healthful, right? Because it's interesting talking about Vesta and chastity and fertility. Sterility is a weird word because most people are like, sterile, you mean like barren, like a sterile, nothing grows here. But not that type of sterile. We need things to be sterile for them to be fertile in the right ways. So I see a lot of that, but I also see folks like actors. I've seen people who work in finance, where like it's not necessarily a collaborative position. The task itself can be done internally, whether or not one's depending on other people, right? Because the Vestal Virgins, by the time we get to Rome, they're a group. It's not just like one person left to themselves, like stay up forever eternally and never let the fire go out. That would never work. But it's like these folks where like the rules of engagement really matter. If you don't interface correctly, the whole system breaks down. So seeing like that kind of juxtaposition makes a lot of sense, especially thinking about those Vestals that like, all right, so, you know, especially when we're thinking about the relationship between like the super family of Rome, right? If they're tending the fire that represents the safety, the strength, or the might of the city itself, then allowing the rules that govern protecting the city to fall apart would be tantamount to like tearing down the city walls.
Totally, totally. And like the attention to detail that I think can be in that signification of Vesta in a natal chart, it does go back to the attention to detail when you are tending and caring for an altar. If any listeners do practice magic or even something like, it could be astrological magic, which is extremely complicated. It could be more of a your own sort of witchcraft, or even I'm thinking about electional astrology and how much of a nut I am when I'm like electing certain things, and that sort of attention to detail. Well, if you fuck up your altar, if you're doing an offering to a planet, and at least in astrological magic, maybe this isn't in so much like a pop witchcraft kind of thing, but in like an astrological, like we're in the Picatrix, we are doing some shit. If you have the wrong stone, the wrong minute, the wrong moon, the thing isn't going to work. And you're lucky if that's all that happens. If it doesn't, you know, like, it's like if it doesn't work, you're lucky. If anything, it might backfire. And that kind of relates to Vesta as well. Like, there is such a attention to detail, but it's because you're attending to the details of a god, right? And you want to give the god or the universe the proper treatment, or like the proper offerings or whatnot.
Yes. You were talking about a firefighters, and I happened to live with someone who was a firefighter. So I'm pondering over their chart, and I'm like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Just like with a fire, like firefighters, one of the techniques that I know firefighters use to control fire is more fire. So strategically lighting fires so that the fire can't expand because there's no new fuel for it to reach. But if you do that wrong, then you can create a situation. So like an inferno, such a cool word, but a terrifying concept, where the fire becomes so big that it's like creating its own wind, and then can just like the air is so hot, it ignites stuff nearby. this is like the worst possible situation. But thinking about that like Picatrix style thing where like you're lucky if the worst thing that happens is that it doesn't work. You use the wrong firefighting strategy, and the worst thing that can happen is that you actually like box yourself into a fire, or you create a situation where like the air is exploding.
Yes. But here's the thing. Here's where it's like, here's the, like the dichotomy of that. Like, okay, there's the Vesta Hestia ritual that it's like, you are the divine altar boy who knows exactly like what to put on the altar to make the gods happy. But then guess what? We all have magic, sex magic within ourselves, and we have that divine creativity. We have a sort of like spark of divine fire within us that is about like our ability to manifest as humans. And I guess I'll put manifest in quotes because that sometimes tends to be like a little bit of a word that some people can kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of different definitions of what that means. But yeah, I'm thinking about now, okay, there's that kind of magic, but there's also like sex magic, and any old regular Joe could do some sex magic and, I don't know, manifest $5 or whatever. I'm thinking about this, this sort of magic that is available to all of us, but in a sacred way, maybe I'm kind of bastardizing it a little bit. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've been really exploring, particularly with Hestia, is that like there isn't a ton of information because, and this the speculation, you know, amongst classicists and academics is that, well, Hestia was worshipped at home in the central hearth. But like, no, we don't have like short of a Pompeii type of event where we're like literally crystallizing a moment in time. We're not going to see what it looked like when somebody cooked and threw the first piece of meat into the fire before they started eating breakfast, you know, in the same way that like really early Hermes that was associated with the Herms, these like pillars that people would erect near their front doors. We know that that was a thing, but we don't see a ton of these really homey folk practices. So there is this like intersection between the folk practices and this more like ceremonial, formal, religious, state sanctioned. We could use lots of different kind of words around like, you know, the Vestal Virgins and like the altar and the exact right ways. And what I find interesting here is like that sex connection is like one of the things that I discovered where it's like, okay, so how do we, what's the connection between sex magic, sacred sexuality and chastity, and like literally completely abstaining from sex or celibacy, because that's what was going on. And for me, that like early teenage exploration with celibacy, because of Buddhism, actually illuminates this, that energy is libidinal. Right? So like libido, pure, creative, it's kind of erotic. If we want to use Eros as a concept there too, I think it can work. But if we're thinking about like fire as the spirit creative energy that is harnessed, then thinking about, well, if we're choosing to contain all of that sexual energy and we're only allowing ourselves to direct it outwardly in these specific ways, then that's a huge amount of creative energy that then can be unleashed towards the most elaborate altar rituals and ceremonial magic and associations possible, or to really potent, like, you know, self-sex magic. It's a really, really effective one. Or these other types of more like personal gnosis, individual animistic types of harnessing our creative, like the creative fire and way that we're able to build that. I guess personal gnosis is as close as I can get, or the best set of words I can think of. But there is something really that gets unleashed through the process of like containing that Vesta is very much about.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's just kind of reminding me too, like if we do, if we have sort of like a sexual relationship with someone, you know, and maybe this is a little bit heteronormative, but okay, what did they tell you in sex ed at school? If we want to quote Mean Girls, like, if you have sex, you'll get pregnant and die. But in in that sort of Mean Girls quote, okay, we have sort of this, we have this very limited view of like sex magic, like sex creates stuff, okay? Now, if we want to expand that, like from way beyond just like this heteronormative man and woman making a baby kind of sex, every time we engage in a sexual experience, whether that be with someone else, whether that just be with our own selves, there is creative magic in that. But these things can create good and bad vibes, I think. And I think Demetra George, if I'm remembering the history correctly, when she was talking a little bit more about like pre-Hellenistic Greece, Hestia times, when there's this sort of idea of the women who are, you know, having transcendent healing sex with like warriors who are back from war and they're really wounded and psychologically distressed and like in the sexual act of sort of bringing them back to life. The goal in that act was not to make a child. The goal in that act was like bringing life, fire back into the body. Now, if they, I believe if they did get pregnant, that baby was seen as like a very divine being. But yeah, yeah. And I think now I'm kind of just riffing off of Demetra George a little bit, but I think she also mentions that some of the king, the first kings of the Roman Empire were children of like these Hestia kind of goddesses or something along those lines. So I might have, don't quote me on that, but there's something about divine babies being created.
And have to go back to the divine babies.
Yeah.
I've been like still wrapping my head around the daughter of Kronos bit and Kronos devouring his children. I'm like, right, his children, these are the creations of the mind. There's some like interesting metaphysical stuff going on there, but that is a whole different tangent and aside. Yeah, it's really interesting to see the different responses to what happens if a Vestal has sex. And is it just the act of sex? Is it who they have sex with? Is it whether or not a baby is created? Are they, is this bad? Is this the worst thing ever? Is it an affront to the gods or to society? Are both people punished? Is just one of them punished? And like when, where, and why those things happen? And I think it all comes back and points to this. And I was thinking too about this, like, you know, unleashing through containing and protocol and propriety, how that's related, that like the price for this unlimited freedom, in some ways unlimited freedom, more unlimited than anyone else is going to get to experience, right? Like fire is this thing that like, okay, well, we can't actually fully harness fire. We can't actually control it. But if we let it get out of control, it will categorically destroy us. We know this. And so it feels like Vesta is very much about, whether we're thinking Vesta or Hestia, it's very much about this like understanding of the greater amount of permission we have to act autonomously, the more and more important it becomes that we act insidiously. Mm-hmm. And that we like really understand the impact of our actions on that larger social scale, especially if we get to be celebrities or be people who are operating more independently from the rest of society or have significant powers. You know, if you're the person who's brewing the beer, if you're the person who's tending the central hearth, like the central hearth goes out, everyone dies. If there is no source of fire, you know, for the folks, like anybody's lived really, really far north or somewhere where it gets like below sub 50 or like negative 50, you know, up in Fairbanks, Alaska, they don't shut down schools because it snows. That can't happen. But if it gets below a certain temperature, you don't leave the house because it is dangerous for the fire to go out. There is literally a point at which everyone's survival is dependent on ensuring we have access to warmth. And so thinking about like that level of responsibility, okay, you can be fire itself. You can be something that no one will attempt to control. But the flip side of that is that you cannot be so uncontrolled that you burn society to the ground. And because we rely so heavily on you, you must be someone who can be depended upon.
Ooh. Wow, Bear, how fascinating is that, that you have Vesta on your ascendant? And that was actually like the kind of environment that, part of the environment that you said your maternal lineage is from. So how much of your, but you were raised more in Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. So I was born in Washington State, and I've spent like half my life in the Bay Area, actually down in California. But a lot of my family's still up in Alaska. And I did spend some time out in the bush in my village as a kid. And then as a young adult, I spent some time living in Fairbanks in the city through the winter time. So I've had a bit of that, that northern thing. And I also got like a bunch of Scandinavian ancestry too. So when I get back in there, there's a lot of folks who are like, no, it gets really cold and we don't mess around with fire. One of the things that is actually an unexpected parallel is that for my people, there's this particular fungus that grows in the roots of birch trees that you would carry the coal from one camp to the next. And that's how you keep the fire going. If that coal goes out, particularly in the wintertime, how are you starting your next fire? So there is this like the most important sacred role is ensuring that we've got that access to fire. And there is one group of folks who I can't even give you an accurate geographic portion of the continent of Africa, nor the name of this group of people. But I saw a documentary recently. This is going to drive me nuts for the rest of the day. There is a group that to this day, they keep the village fire going. And this has been a practice for millennia upon millennia, that there is a woman who is entrusted, and it's usually the chief's wife. And like the most important woman in the group is the one who is tasked with ensuring that the fire continues to burn. And so they say, and of course we're going to, what the elder women say, that's the word is law as far as my people are concerned. The fire has been burning continuously for thousands of years. And that's why their culture continues to exist for thousands of years. So there's like multiple different groups of people throughout the world who have this type of relationship with fire. And it makes sense that humans would have that, you know, like Michael Pollan in one of his more recent, I think Netflix documentaries, talks about the fact that it's arguable what makes humans different from other animals, but definitely we're the only species that cooks with fire.
Yeah, I think this might like almost, hopefully this sparks some inspiration with anybody who's watching or listening, like thinking to your own roots and your cultures and, you know, if you have the privilege to know about your maternal or paternal lines, like, yeah, what was the culture surrounding fire? For me, I'm just like, I'm my mom's Italian. So I'm thinking of in the Catholic Church, like there's gotta be a candle they don't let go out, and there's got to be an altar boy or something that always is like keeping this candle going. Like that's what I'm thinking about, but could be totally different for someone else's family's culture. But these are real life best themes that we can see in our lives.
Especially with Italian heritage, I would wonder like, where is the literal Vestal? Like, is there a practice that goes back to Vesta that just like got subsumed by the Catholic Church? Like, where does that show up?
Right. Yeah. And I'll have to tell you sometime. I'll have to explore Vesta and my own chart a little bit with you more. But I will say my grandma, she was born in Italy in like the 1930s. And she was born out of wedlock. Like, they don't know who her father is. We don't know. And so that feels very Vesta to me. And her mom, my great grandma, was known to be very like almost like virginic. Like she never had like a relationship, like this kind of stuff. So it's weird. Like, we're like, where did my grandma come from? Was my grandma this immaculate conception? Like, who's her dad? Like, I don't know. So it's that feels very Vesta too. Like, who's my father? Or is sex considered a sin in my family? Has that shame around sex been inherited through my certain family lines? Or is that more of a societal conditioning for me? This is all, I think, very relative to that Vesta conversation as well.
Yeah. I mean, even the idea, like, I think a lot about the fact that, you know, like you said earlier, we're talking about like 8-year-old girls who would then take these vows in service to the god, to the goddess, yes. And then they would then go to the state-sponsored temple, and there they would grow up. So it, like, you were talking about children who then become, yes, they're autonomous in some way, and they're not property of their fathers, and they won't be exchanged to their future husbands, but then they become like part of the family of Rome, like that supra family, you know. And so I think thinking about that relationship there, whether it's like, you know, being raised without a father by a single parent, or even just having, I think for a lot of like millennials, this kind of like being raised by the internet a little bit, just like when our relationship with family becomes more society at large than just our like individual family or our individual communities, even thinking about how mobile millennials are, whereas most humans through most of human history never went more than like 10 miles away from the place that they were born.
Yeah. Oh, that's big. And now I'm thinking too, I mean, we'll have to find some kind of good wrap-up point at some point, but now I'm speaking to like, okay, 8 years old, that's like a child who is not menstruating, is not fertile. There has to be some kind of metaphor between of like, why is it 8 years old when, or 7 or 8 years old when the Vestal Virgins are initiated? Is it because there's sort of this like immortalized kind of virginity going on with like the non-menstruating girl, the sort of nubile girl? Like, is there something there? And I'm also kind of thinking about Vesta perhaps in relationship to, like you said, child going away from home, but also where was the first like loss of innocence, you know, as a child? Like, when did that kid at school like tell you about sex and like got to you before your parents could talk to you? Or maybe your parents didn't even give you a sex talk because they themselves were so uncomfortable with the subject. So you had to go and get that information from someone at school who then fed you a bunch of baloney about whatever it is, you know. So that to me, there's something there too. I don't know. Maybe I'm making shit up at this point, but yeah.
I mean, the first thing that jumped out in my head was like, well, by 7, you get your first Saturn square. So there's like that Saturn connection there. And if we're thinking about like, you know, Hestia is the firstborn and lastborn, and squares is like kind of like disgorging, then yeah, okay, so around 7 or 8 you're like, no, we're cutting it off from the family of origin. But also thinking about like this how do I say it? And did this train of thought leave the station already? This train of thought may have decided that that's all we're going to say about that part. Oh, right. That's about the age at which kids get super, super curious anyways. So I think that's like, you know, doctor, nurse, show me yours, I show you mine, that kind of stuff. Like kids have developed, they've become full people. They're not like, having worked with various age kids throughout like AmeriCorps and stuff like that, like a five-year-old is like very, very, very large baby. You know, they can do a lot of stuff, but they have not yet accumulated enough experience that they are fully an individual self. And a seven-year-old is like the tiniest, tiniest adult possible. So like somewhere around that 7 or 8 year old age, there is a shift from like, I'm like, you know, I'm darting between the legs of my parent, whoever my caregiver is, and like hiding under and behind you to like, okay, I'm literally too big to be like between your legs, peering out at the adults. I'm now curious. I now know that this body is mine. All right, cool. If this body is yours, now's the time that we start, like, we have rules about how we interact with other people in their bodies. But that's the first thing that jumped out of mind.
Yeah. Feels
about right. A little made up, though. Yeah.
We gotta take all of this back to our client sessions and keep doing some research on real life stories. And I'm trying to think of, like, what could be a good place to kind of wrap up with you, Bear? And maybe I could ask, what is your guidance for any astrological student listening who is recognizing some of these themes in their own life, however bizarre the connection may be? How do we like work with Vesta? You know, the first thing that comes to mind is like, for some reason, I feel intuitively like, don't work with her if your space is messy. I don't know why, but like maybe maybe it's like that sacred hearth kind of thing. But yeah, what has it been like working with her? How do you work with her as a goddess? And what has bringing her into your life, how has that kind of helped you on your spiritual path?
This is the perfect wrap up. Yeah, she definitely likes you to keep your house clean. There's the rites and rituals really do matter. Kind of in a similar way to like Saturn. Like if you're going to start a Saturn practice, keep your promise. If you can only commit to once a month, then say, I will do this once a month and maybe do extra and Saturn will be pleased. Do not overpromise. For me personally, working with Hestia, when I like made the switch from, okay, I recognize that like sacred sexuality, yes, celibacy, yes. House of Altars is my half joking name for my house. I've literally had almost every single horizontal surface is an altar, has some type of candle or cloth or whatever. If you feel called to work with Hestia or Vesta, formalize the practice in some small way. Real clear rituals. The word praxis is a really good one. It's all about going from theoretical to practical, pragmatic, and enacted. So like when you're making an offering, it's not just, I have this moment where I think about you. Actually say something out loud. Actually give an offering, even if it's a glass of water, even if it's like the first bite of your food. If, you know, money's tight, you're feeling food scarce, the idea of throwing away a bite of food, you're like, cannot do that. Then you can just like, Hestia, I take this first bite of food in your honor. And then like, take that bite of food and really like, offer it. I think getting personal and devotional is the best way that I can think to just broadly describe engaging with Vesta. For me, I've had a practice for about 2 years of reciting the Orphic hymns every morning during the sunrise hour. So every day of the week, the first hour around sunset, for those who don't know, you know, today's Wednesday, so today is Mercury's day. At sunrise, I said the hymn to Hermes. But before that, I said the hymn to Hestia. Hestia gets the first offering. whether it's prayer, whether it's incense, whatever else. And since doing that, I've actually become much tidier, much more clean. As someone with ADD, cleanliness and tidiness, that's like, that is a weakness for me. But since working with Hestia, I just, every morning, I find it actually quite easy to spend a couple minutes tidying up my space, even if it's just the space where your hearth is. So you can start small. Whatever your altar is, give one space that you dedicate to Hestia. If you can keep a candle continuously lit safely and per your housing agreements and all that kind of stuff, go ahead and go for it. It's also totally acceptable to just like light a tea light and let it go out. I've had to have some talks like, this is fire safety. We live in modern times. These are the reasons that we can't do this. But like, just like you would with a housemate, you know, you can talk to Hestia. Hestia doesn't have to be a lady either. Like, however you understand the spirit of fire. If you can't have fire, play one of those like Christmas log YouTube channel things so you can get the sound of crackling electrical fire. But really just, I think the biggest things, autonomy, sovereignty, dedication. Where did those three things show up? What parts of your life allow you to be fully dedicated in a way where you are fully autonomous, fully yourself? Vesta wants your attention there. What are the rites and rituals that make that part of your life function and function? Those are the rites and the rituals, and like, that's what you want to be. That's your Vesta altar work. If you can maintain an altar, great. If you can have a dedicated altar for Hestia, great. If not, then just bringing that, treating your own life, right? Because if we go all the way back to Hestia, what they're really saying is having a fire to cook on is sacred. Having food that you can eat hot is sacred. So have that hot meal. Offer that first bite to your ancestors, to spirit, to being grateful to have food, whatever it is. Like, get personal, because it was about your home practice. It's like the ultimate like house poker rules apply when it comes to Vesta, so long as it feels sacred to you.
That's beautiful. I love that. Yeah. I'm imagining, everybody after this episode going on YouTube, going to the the fire background channel and kind of having that up throughout the day. And what does it feel like to kind of honor this goddess or this figure or this energy, and have that also be about honoring your own sovereignty and autonomy? And maybe even your own divine sexuality or your inherent connection to God or your inner altar priestess within you, whatever you kind of want to make of Hestia, because there's obviously, as we've discussed, a lot of different roads we can go down.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Vera. I'm so glad we talked about this.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mal. This has been wonderful.
Awesome.